From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Tim Robbins, the star of The Shawshank Redemption, The Player, and Bull Durham. He also wrote and directed Dead Man Walking. He wrote and directed the new film Cradle Will Rock. It's based on a true story that has become part of theater lore about the making of the 1937 pro-labor musical The Cradle Will Rock. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from pop wonderboy Beck, and book critic Maureen Corrigan goes beyond Harry Potter to find more children's books adults should check out. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Justice Department officials say they've written the Cuban father of a 6-year-old boy in Florida, explaining what he must do to arrange the boy's return to Cuba. The boy's mother died at sea last month while trying to reach Florida in a raft. The boy survived and is staying with relatives in Florida who say he should remain with them. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
Deputy U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder told reporters today that U.S. immigration officials sent a letter late yesterday to the father of 6-year-old Elian Gonzalez. The letter explains that Juan Miguel Gonzalez must show he's really Elian's father by providing documents such as school or medical records or even family photographs. Immigration officials say they also need to interview Gonzalez to determine he really does want Elian returned to live with him in Cuba. Holder said U.S. immigration officials will make the final decision on whether to send the boy back to his father in Cuba. Under U.S., Cuban, and international law, Holder said, the desire of a parent is one of the main factors determining whether children should be returned to their home country. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Tens of thousands of people gathered today in Worcester, Massachusetts, to honor 6 firefighters who were killed last Friday in a warehouse fire. Thousands of firefighters from around the country marched through the streets as part of the memorial. Meanwhile, the search continues for the bodies of 4 of those firemen who remain missing in the smoking wreckage. Hillary Rodham Clinton is separating herself from her husband's policy toward gays in the military. She says she doesn't think the don't ask, don't tell approach has made it any easier for gays to serve. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
At a press conference in New York City today, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton said the don't ask, don't tell policy hasn't worked. She said fitness to serve in the military should be based on conduct, not sexual orientation. Mrs. Clinton said she wasn't uncomfortable taking a different position on the issue than her husband. She said she was going to be a candidate for Senate, and from time to time she will be taking different positions. But in this case, her position is now in sync with that of her expected rival for the Senate, New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Mrs. Clinton first spoke about the issue at a Manhattan fundraiser sponsored by a gay rights group that raised $100,000 for her campaign. The First Lady has also taken positions at odds with the Clinton administration on the pardon of a group of jailed Puerto Rican nationalists. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Search and rescue teams have pulled 11 survivors unhurt from the waters off San Diego, and they're searching for 7 crew members who remain missing after a Marine helicopter crashed this afternoon. Authorities say the helicopter was on a training mission from the USS Pecos when it went down. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 66 points today to close at 11,134. This is NPR. The Federal Aviation Administration says a small plane crashed into a residential area in northeastern New Jersey today. There are conflicting reports on casualties. The crash set at least one house on fire in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey. U.S. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke is in Africa to build support for the peace process in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In Rwanda, Holbrooke called the genocide of 1994 an avoidable tragedy, and he stressed the need to get a lasting peace for Congo. Chris Simpson reports from Kigali.
In calling for a genuine solution to Congo's problems, Richard Holbrooke warned that lessons had to be learned from what he described as the calamities of Bosnia, Somalia, and Rwanda. This time round, the international community has to get it right, he said. But only if the parties involved in the conflict were serious about their commitments. He said that meant choosing a facilitator to establish a national dialogue and allowing UN liaison teams to go where they pleased. He made it clear the peace process had to pick up speed. Holbrooke still has to meet the leaders of Uganda and Congo, as well as the Congolese rebels, before flying home. For NPR News, this is Chris Simpson in Kigali.
In Newark, New Jersey today, a computer programmer pleaded guilty to creating and distributing a virus that caused more than $80 million in damage to email systems last March. David L. Smith pleaded guilty to state and federal charges stemming from the Melissa virus. The 31-year-old programmer said he didn't anticipate the amount of damage that the virus would cause. Smith is believed to be among the first people ever prosecuted for creating a computer virus. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Tim Robbins, the star of such films as Arlington Road, The Player, Bob Roberts, Bull Durham, and The Shawshank Redemption. He wrote and directed Dead Man Walking, Bob Roberts, and the new film Cradle Will Rock. The new film is about the making of the 1937 musical The Cradle Will Rock, which was written by Mark Blitzstein, directed by Orson Welles, and produced by the Federal Theater Project, which was created as part of FDR's New Deal to put theater people back to work and bring affordable theater to the public. The storyline of Blitzstein's musical was about union activists demanding their rights in a town run by Big Steel. Tim Robbins' movie tells the story of this production and the confrontation it provoked between the players and the government, a story that has become part of theater lore. The movie stars John Turturro, Emily Watson, Susan Sarandon, John Cusack, Vanessa Redgrave, and Bill Murray. Here's an excerpt from the cast recording of the 1938 Broadway production of The Cradle Will Rock, featuring Howard Da Silva.
And it's going to surround you. No wonder those storm birds seem to circle around you. When you can't climb down and you can't say no, you can't stop the weather, not with all your dough. When the wind blows, when the wind blows, the cradle will rock.
That was the composer Mark Blitzstein at the piano. Here's that song from the soundtrack of Tim Robbins' new movie, Cradle Will Rock.
The topmost bough of yonder tree now, like bees in their hives, the lords in their lackeys and wives, are swinging rock of my baby in a nice big cradle. And baby mock the air is chilly up there, the sky beats a cloud, can that be a cloud over there? And then they pull out their hands and fear stormy weather.
Tim Robbins, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
How were you introduced to the musical The Cradle Will Rock, and why did you want to make a film about the making of it?
A couple of producers brought this story to me and told me this story of the first public performance of The Cradle Will Rock, and which was, I had never heard about. I had studied theater in college, and I'd never been told this story, which I found remarkable in itself. But it was such an amazing evening, such a inspiring performance that I felt like it had to be the end of a movie. It had to be the climax of a movie. And so my job in writing Cradle Will Rock was really working backwards, filling in the spaces. How did we get to that theater on that June night in 1937?
The Cradle Will Rock was produced by a project within the Federal Theater Project that was run by Orson Welles and John Houseman. And
yes.
This musical was set to open on June 16th, 1937, but when the actors showed up, the theater was locked, and they weren't allowed in. The audience wasn't allowed in. What were the reasons that the theater was locked that night?
Well, it's surrounded by armed troops. They had shut the theater down. The reason being, I think there was a very volatile time, and the content of the play had to do with a labor strike. A week before that, there had been some terrible violence in a labor strike in the Midwest, a couple of labor strikes in the Midwest, resulting in deaths and injuries. And it was a particularly volatile time. And so I believe the government, under a different reason, of course, but they closed it down because I thought they thought the play was incendiary and would have caused more problems. So Wells and Houseman get to this theater, and being the young, brash, wonderful, kind of arrogant, beautifully talented people that they were, decided to sneak into the back of the theater and use the telephones to find a different theater. So they got down there and manned this kind of command central as actors and musicians started to show up in this backstage dressing room, and eventually find a different theater uptown. Now, they have 1,000 people coming to that performance that evening at the original theater, and they find this new theater 20 blocks uptown, and by this time they've also realized that the actors and musicians have been forbidden from performing by their unions. They've been forbidden from performing this pro-labor play by their unions. So the deep irony of that, and this terrible, you know, now they've got a theater, but they have got no one to perform the play. So they turn to Mark Blitzstein, the composer, and they say, will you do it all by yourself? Will you perform all of the parts? And he said, yeah, I'll do it. He wasn't a member of a union. He felt he could do it. So he and Wells and Houseman and some of the actors start marching uptown with 1,000 people in tow. And they get to this new theater, and Wells introduces Blitzstein, and Blitzstein starts to do the play by himself.
Is this your first time directing a musical? Your movie isn't a musical per se, but it's about the making of a musical, and you restage parts of the musical within the film.
Yeah, it's actually Bob Roberts was kind of a musical in a way, too.
That's true. That's true.
Music's always been really important for me. I think that it's difficult to do the musical as a musical on film, like all of a sudden a character breaks character and starts to sing. It's always a weird reality. So I'm always looking for ways that you can incorporate music in a reality-based way. How does a song happens on film that is not a character stepping out of his character to sing I Love You to somebody?
Well, that's why the backstage musical has always been such a good device in movies.
Yes.
And I guess in a way, that's what your movie is. It's a
believe me, I watched all of them.
Politicized backstage musical. You watched all of them to make this?
Oh yeah, I love the Busby Berkeley musicals.
Those are great.
I also drew a lot of inspiration from the screwball comedies of the '30s, the Capra, Sturgis, Howard Hawks kind of style of film. Wonderful quick dialogue and witty repartee and wonderfully eccentric characters mixed in with a realism of the society around them. You know, people. There was an acknowledgement of what was going on in the '30s in those films, and I've always found that interesting because you do have a filmmaker that is aware. They're not ignoring the society around them. I think that happens an awful lot today, is that you have comedies, and they're sometimes quite funny, but they ignore what's going on in the society. And in fact, maybe those are the political films, the ones that ignore the social and the economic and the political.
Tim Robbins is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new movie, Cradle Will Rock. Now, a lot of Cradle Will Rock is about censorship, overt and veiled forms of censorship. And I'm wondering if you had any direct dealings with any of your work with censorship or with a movie company backing out of something because it was too hot to handle, too controversial.
I've been very, very fortunate. I've never been, censored. I don't think I really have a right to complain about anything. I have a very healthy career. I get to work when I want to. I get paid well. When I direct, I'm able to determine the content of what I do, and I am able to have final cut. and a big say in the way it's distributed. And I've had nothing but support from the people I've worked with. So I can't really say that I've been censored. I think, though, that what's working these days is a more kind of clever kind of suppression of information than out-and-out censorship. I don't think there's anyone that's really trying to close things down other than some politicians for, you know, to put on a show, which they know is futile, but they figure they'll get a lot of press by doing it. I think there's more suppression of creativity in a more subtle form of censorship, which has to do with, you know, limiting access.
I want to ask you a question about the historical accuracy of the movie. There's several different stories that are happening simultaneously in your film. One is the story of the musical The Cradle Will Rock. Another is a story of how Nelson Rockefeller commissioned the artist Diego Rivera to paint a mural for Rockefeller Center that was being built. And Diego Rivera creates this really political mural with a picture of Lenin within the mural, and Rockefeller has it kind of blasted away. I mean, he tears apart, has his people tear apart the mural because it's too left-wing. And the Cradle Will Rock story and the Diego Rivera mural story actually happened several years apart.
Right.
But they're happening simultaneously in your movie.
Right.
And I'm wondering why you felt the need to make them so simultaneous.
Well, I think that's an artistic license you have to take when you're dealing with things that are from the past and, you know, based in reality. At the very beginning of the movie, the first credit says, a mostly true story. And I put that in there because there you have to create fiction in a historical epic of this nature. Even if you say you don't, you are, because you can't possibly have known what happened in the back rooms and what conversations were verbatim. You have to use your imagination to fill in the spaces. Now, the difference in years was there was a four-year difference. 1932 is when the mural fiasco happened, and 1936 is when the Federal Theater, and 1937 into Cradle Will Rock. I figured, you know, listen, if you really want to be historically accurate about this, we could do some kind of, we could either ignore the fact that there were these two very similar stories of censorship and creative expression, or we could, you know, do some kind of weirdness with time and make it really accurate so that everyone knows that we have been completely to the letter accurate. I felt it was okay to take the license, as I did with other parts of the story. I mean, we don't know for sure that Marion Davies wound up at a table at 21 Club partying with Orson Welles and John Houseman as Hearst looks on. We don't know for sure a lot of these things. We don't know if Nelson Rockefeller wound up dancing with the models in Diego's studio. But I think it's in a sense of fun, in a sense of just in a sense of creativity and imagination that you fill in the gaps with this kind of story.
You are a film star and director who has occasionally used your visibility to call attention to political issues, whether it's, you know, at the Academy Awards or through your movies. I mean, Dead Man Walking calls attention to the death penalty, Bob Roberts to a certain form of a politician and political campaign. And your new movie is about, you know, a musical that arose from the labor movement and that was about the labor movement. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you see the nature of celebrity and political issues, you know, like using your stature to call attention to issues that you think are important.
Well,
and where are the parameters of it? Where you feel like it's appropriate and where you feel it's kind of inappropriate?
I don't think it's it should be a requirement. I feel like I'm doing what I've always done. From a very early age, I've been aware of what's going on around me, and you know, I remember very early on being aware of the civil rights movement, the war in Vietnam, and I guess the way I would think about it was, why should I change because I became famous? You know, a lot of people do. A lot of people get very safe and try to make their career, advance their career in their public actions and refused to acknowledge things that got them where they are and refused to act the same way that they had always been acting. I feel like I'm just, you know, basically being honest and being true to who I am. Now, it doesn't mean every celebrity should be doing what I occasionally do, which is try to call attention to things that don't get the attention in the media. Listen, if we were living in a perfect world, I'd be able to go and, you know, live completely talking about my shoes and my hairstyle. But we don't live in a world where media goes and covers certain events unless celebrities are there. That's the tragedy, is that it takes celebrities to get the media interested in certain causes. And as long as that's the way things are run, then I believe it's a personal responsibility for some of us to do that, to call attention to these people that are working really hard to try to get attention, try to make the world a better place.
My guest is Tim Robbins. He wrote and directed the new film Cradle Will Rock. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tim Robbins, and he wrote and directed the new film Cradle Will Rock. I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about some of your other films as well. And since we're in the middle of a political campaign, I thought we could start with Bob Roberts, which you directed and starred in. This is a film about a folk-singing right-wing born-again candidate for Senate, and the movie is a mockumentary, a fake documentary. Let me play a short excerpt.
Bob Roberts, fencing enthusiast, poet, folk singer, businessman, senatorial candidate. This controversial yet extraordinarily popular entertainer first appeared on the music scene 3 years ago with his debut album, The Freewheelin' Bob Roberts. Despite being assailed by the music critics as a corrupt, unfair diatribe against the 60s, the album remarkably soared to number 23 on the Billboard charts. Backed by a team of novices, without the support of a major record label, relying on word of mouth and his own team of businessmen and associates, who seem more suited to a townhouse than a tour bus, Roberts created a niche for himself in a business that at first had contemptuously rejected
him. Bob Roberts was a folk singing candidate. And your new movie is a backstage musical. Did you do much singing on stage yourself, either in theater or in clubs?
Well, I can say that's probably one of the most terrifying things for me is to stand on stage alone. You know, it was okay with Bob because I had a character to hide behind. But it's I always am terribly afraid that I'm going to screw up the chords, and I usually do when I'm playing alone on stage. So. But I love singing, and I feel like I there's a frustrated rock and roller in me somewhere.
Did you play in bands?
No, I just I've sat in with friends and jammed and things like that and had fun that way. I have some singer friends that I mess around with sometimes, but it's who wants to see another actor turn rock and roller? I mean. They'd be sharpening their knives for that one, I think.
We talked a little bit the last time you were on the show about how your father was a member of the folk group The Highwaymen in the early 60s. And they had the hits Michael Row Your Boat Ashore and Cotton Fields. Mm-hmm. Did they see themselves as political?
Well, I don't believe so. I mean, I think a certain amount, pretty much everyone in folk at the time was doing something of content. You know, there were certain songs that made their way through every group, and it was very much a I don't think you really had, maybe you had like a few of the more top kind of groups that avoided political things at all costs and probably stayed on top because of that.
Did you get taken to sing-alongs as a kid?
I did. I got, I remember one of my first memories was my dad on stage, and I remember the whole audience singing along with the Highwaymen, and I felt, wow, that's really great, you know. My dad's doing that, you know. It's, you know, corny, but it was inspiring. It was nice to hear.
I used to feel so uncomfortable at sing-alongs. Because if you don't sing, then you're considered a real, like, you know, stick in the mud. And if you do sing, it can be very embarrassing.
Well, you're just supposed to move your lips.
That's right.
It's just, you lip sync.
Did you grow up in Greenwich Village?
Uh-huh.
Now, I mean, did you, when you were growing up in the village, and I imagine a comparatively bohemian life, did you ever want to be in a more mainstream kind of family?
Well, I didn't know any difference. So, and we weren't that, you know, bohemian. We were Catholics, and I went to school every day with a little tie, and I was an altar boy. And so, but we were living in a progressive area, and it was a progressive parish. But it wasn't like we were, you know, sitting around smoking a hookah, you know. But it was a great way to grow up, I have to say, in retrospect. I didn't know it until I went away, how special it was. For me, it was normal. But I was surrounded by wonderful eccentricity and creativity and weirdness. And part of the base, I guess, of who I am is centered in that kind of eccentricity. Walking down the street to go to the park to play baseball, I was passing some pretty colorful characters. So all of that's in my subconscious. You know, I was just a kid wanting to play baseball, but I was passing some of the, you know, most creative and weird people in the country at the time that had come to Greenwich Village.
Tim Robbins will be back in the second half of the show. He wrote and directed the new film, Cradle Will Rock, about the making of the 1937 pro-labor musical, The Cradle Will Rock. From the soundtrack of the movie, here's Emily Watson singing one of the songs from the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm checking home.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Time Magazine, this week a look at Republican candidate John McCain, plus a report on the significance of the WTO protests. And by Garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of over 14,000 plants, tools, and gardening products. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The Player, Dead Man Walking, and Bull Durham. We continue our conversation with Tim Robbins. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD from Beck, and Maureen Corrigan gives her list of kids' books that adults love. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tim Robbins. He starred in Arlington Road, The Shawshank Redemption, The Player, Bob Roberts, and Bull Durham. He wrote and directed Dead Man Walking and the new film Cradle Will Rock. Let's get to another one of your movies. This is one that you starred in, The Player, directed by Robert Altman. It's a great satire of the movie business, and you're a studio executive who everyone in the industry comes to pitch their film ideas. And here's a clip where you're getting pitched by director Alan Rudolph.
What's your pitch?
This is the best. Well, is political scare you?
Political doesn't scare me. Radical political scares me.
Politely politically radical. But
is it funny?
It's funny.
It's a funny political thing.
It's a funny, and it's a thriller, too.
It's a thriller.
And it's all at once.
So what's the story?
Well, I want Bruce Willis. Mm-hmm. I think I can talk to him. It's a story about a senator, a bad guy senator at first. And he's traveling around the country on the country's dime, you know, like that Sununu guy used to.
I see. So sort of a cynical political thriller comedy.
Yeah, but it's got a heart. In the right spot. Uh-huh. And anyway, he has an accident. Yeah, and he becomes clairvoyant, like a psychic.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a psychic political thriller comedy with a heart.
With a heart. And not unlike Ghost meets Manchurian Candidate.
Go on.
Well, Tim Robbins, I'm sure you've been in a lot of situations like this, probably on either end in a way. And I want to ask you if you've been exposed to... you know, what Alan Rudolph says when he starts this pitch, he says, does political thriller scare you, the idea of a political thriller? Have you pitched political ideas to executives thinking like, oh, God, this is really going to terrify them. It's just going to be too political for them.
Well, I have been really, I've never pitched. I've always had a script in hand, and they've either accepted it or rejected it. I've definitely been rejected. As a matter of fact, I remember when Bob Roberts came out, I got calls from certain moguls that shall remain nameless, who said, you know, we thought it's such a great movie. Your next movie, you want to see that script. You know, I want to be the first one to see it. Will you show it to me first? And I did show these people the script, and they couldn't have been less interested in Dead Man Walking. And then Dead Man Walking came out, and the same people, almost to the T, called and said, I want to see your next script. And I showed them Cradle Rock. Couldn't be less interested. So, but once in a while you get lucky, and I was lucky with a working title and Polygram and people that realized that I could do what I could pull it off, you know, Dead Man Walking. And with Cradle, I was lucky to have Joe Roth understand the material and give me the money from Disney.
Did playing a studio executive in The Player make you empathize anymore with the executives who are passing judgment on you?
Not really. Actually, Altman came up to me at the premiere and he said, you know, we've been too nice.
Oh, I don't know.
But it must be a very difficult job. I do have a sympathy for that because it is a creative job because you're making creative decisions, but you're not actually being creative and doing it and exercising and making the thing happen. But then again, how much sympathy can you have? I mean, because they have the potential to do a lot of great things, and sometimes it just gets squandered. Sometimes it just becomes about box office and names, and they don't take the opportunity when presented with it to do something a little bit risky and take a little bit of that profit and turn it into gold, you know?
Well, you mentioned that after the success of Bob Roberts, executives asked to see your next script, and you showed them Dead Man Walking, and the moguls turned it down. Let's hear a scene from Dead Man Walking. And this is based on a true story by Sister Helen Prejean, who works with prisoners on death row. And in this scene, she first meets a prisoner on death row, a convicted murderer, played by Sean Penn.
You know, when I got your letter, I seen Helen on it. I thought it was my first ex-old lady. I almost ripped it up. She turned me in, called the cops. Orphaned our kid, the stupid bitch.
You've got a kid?
Yeah, call him the kid.
Girl or boy?
Girl.
What's her name?
He asked a lot of questions.
I don't know you.
Yeah, well, never mind. Your letter, you say you work with poor people. Your daddy was a lawyer. You know, you come from money, don't you?
Some.
Mm. You live in St. Thomas Projects? I don't get that. I don't know who's crazier, you and me.
I live where I work.
Yeah, in the slum.
What about you?
I live here.
You were brought up poor.
Ain't nobody with money on death row.
You and I have something in common.
What's that?
We both live with the poor.
Tim Robbins' Dead Man Walking was based on true stories of several people. And I imagine that you felt you wanted to get everything right, not only for the sake of the movie, but for the sake of the feelings of the people involved here, including the parents of the people who were murdered by the characters that Sean Penn is a composite of. And I'm wondering if you were surprised by some of the things that you discovered in actually meeting with people who the story is based on, you know, the woman who's raped, the parents of a woman who was killed, Sister Helen Prejean. Were there things that you were just, like, emotionally surprised by?
Well, yes, constantly with that movie. The whole experience was an incredible learning experience. I wanted to show... I didn't want to be condescending about the murder victims' families. There's such a terrible tragedy that they go through, and I wanted to give them a dignity, and which they have. They're not. They're very. They have a point. You know, there is something in everyone's nature that wants to protect the ones we love, and if the ones we love safety is compromised, or if God forbid there's a tragedy, we want to avenge it. The question then becomes, you know, like, who avenges it, and who is avenged? And I'm very uncomfortable with the government making those decisions, because ultimately it's always an economic decision. Like he says in that scene, you don't find any rich people on death row. So it's an arbitrary decision, and it's never going to be fair. And as long as you have that, it's going to be an unfair system. I wouldn't, even if they were to execute rich people, I wouldn't condone it, because I don't believe in crossing that line. I don't believe in violence. I don't believe in any kind of violence.
What kind of discussions did you have with Sean Penn about how to portray the killer? And even how he would look. I mean, the goatee and the kind of slicked back, tall pompadour seemed so right for the character.
Yeah, it's. I think Sean had a little experience in prison, so he took that and worked with that. The hair is a very specific thing. I mean, it is something that happens in prison. Guys have a lot of time on their hands, and they do spend it on their hair. You know, that's it's not unusual to find a guy with a kind of pompadour. Sean is an amazing actor. He's really, I think when you're watching him work, you're watching a vivisection in a lot of ways. You know, he's really opening himself up in a very dangerous and personal way, as is Susan. I mean, watching the two of them together was just a beautiful thing. You know, our job was to make sure that they had an environment to do what they do best in and not get in the way, and it was really, you know, what a wonderful experience it was to watch them work together.
Well, let me play a scene from the film in which you met Susan Sarandon, and this is a scene from Bull Durham in which you played a kind of goofy pitcher, a pitcher who's very, very good, but kind of personally goofy. And Susan Sarandon is an experienced woman who usually takes on a new player each year and becomes their mentor, both kind of in baseball and in intimacy as well. and so here's a scene in which she's giving you directions in pitching.
This is ridiculous. I'm a professional.
Will you just give it a try and lean in? Thank you. Now, I want you to breathe through your eyelids.
My eyelids?
Yeah, like the lava lizards at the Galapagos Islands. See, there's some lizards, they have Prada eye behind the head so they can see backwards. Haven't you ever noticed how Fernando Valenzuela, he just doesn't even look when he pitches? He's a Mayan Indian. Or an Aztec, I forget which one. I get them confused.
So do I.
Stand up for a second now.
want you to be aware of the chakra connection between your feet and your testicles.
Chakra?
Yeah, your right leg and your left testicle and your left leg and your right testicle.
I like that.
I bet you do.
Come on. I'm tired of hearing
this. All right. Fire one in there. Come on.
Okay.
You're patronizing me, and I will not be patronized.
If I throw too hard, I'm going to hurt the girl.
This girl has handled a lot of pitchers whose records are a lot better than 1-7.
1-6.
Oh, sorry.
Give me the goddamn ball. How do you like that?
That was much better. Did you see that? Because your delivery was fully integrated because you weren't thinking about it because you were pissed off at me. Now that's...
Well, Tim Robbins, he's a kind of goofy character. The pitcher, was it hard for you to play goofy?
Oh, no. That was a real pleasure. I love that character. I was certainly not hard to dumb down for me. Mm-hmm. Probably because I'm... At the core, I'm pretty dumb.
Oh, there you go.
I went to a very kind of specialized high school in New York called Stuyvesant High School. It's in the public school system, but you have to take a test to get in. And that's how I, you know, it's science and math school. And I found out very early on that I was not going to be a Westinghouse scholar. And that's how I found theater, you know, as a way to feel good about myself in an otherwise very frustrating academic environment.
Did you think you were going to get into science beforehand?
No, I just, you know...
It was just a good school?
Well, it was the school, you know? It was, God, thank God, you know? Because otherwise that there were the public school that I was, you know, my district would have been a, well, probably a disaster for me, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was a way to stay away from that, and we didn't have the money to go to private school, so... And I did get a great education there. It's just I always felt on the lower rungs of the ladder because there were such brilliant kids there.
Uh-huh. You've directed Susan Sarandon in several films. In fact, in your new film, in which she's in Cradle Will Rock, many of the people you're directing, you've worked with before. John Turturro, you first worked with in Five Corners. Mm. Do you like the idea of having a kind of family of actors, people you are already familiar with and comfortable with?
Well, yes, I do, but I also like meeting new people. I mean, there's so many great, talented actors that I would love to work with. And on this film, I got the opportunity to work with Vanessa Redgrave, for example, and Reuben Blades and Cary Elwes and Angus McFadden and Emily Watson, all of whom I hadn't really worked with in the past. And so it's always, you know, it's such a wonderful profession because each new project you're involved in brings with it so many new surprises and new people and new opportunities to expand your own perceptions and consciousness.
Well, one last question. Was it tempting at all to give yourself a part in Cradle Will Rock?
It was, but I it was such a massive undertaking and such an epic and so many things that had to be done. I just felt like I really had to concentrate on orchestrating the chaos. You know, we're juggling, you know, 4 or 5 stories and 20 characters, and it's a lot of balls to keep up in the air, and I just didn't want to be one of those balls that I was keeping up in the air.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Tim Robbins wrote and directed the new film, Cradle Will Rock, about the making of the 1937 pro-labor musical, The Cradle Will Rock. Coming up, books for kids that adults will love, too. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has some gift suggestions for the kids in your life. Books. Books that you'll love, too.
In its annual end-of-year issue, the Sunday New York Times Book Review pronounced that 1999 was just a so-so year for books. Overall, I'd agree, with one huge exception, the category of children's books. Long after many of us forget who won this year's Nobel Prize for Literature, we'll know the name Harry Potter. The three best-selling Harry Potter novels by J.K. Rowling, which were published this year, are adored not only by their target audience of 10 and 11-year-olds, but by hordes of adult readers as well. In fact, the Harry Potter phenomenon has been so extraordinary that it's gotten adults who read children's books to come out of the closet. Even in uptight, lawyerly Washington, D.C., where I live, I've seen people on the bus reading the Harry Potter novels, where once only John Grisham held sway. Such sights got me to wondering about other children's books that appeal to an adult audience. Of course, I thought of the novels of Louisa May Alcott, Lewis Carroll, and Robert Louis Stevenson. But for guidance to less familiar titles, I went to my local independent bookstore, where the clerks know and love literature. Yeah, sometimes the chain bookstores get lucky and hire such people too. But in a scene straight out of the mediocre movie You've Got Mail, when I went to buy a copy of Norton Juster's The Phantom Tollbooth, which the clerk at the Independent recommended but didn't have, the clueless children's section clerk at the chain ran a computer search for Norton Juster's The Phantom Tollbooth, as though the author's name were part of the title. The Phantom Tollbooth, my independent bookstore elf assured me, is a steady seller with adults who don't even bother to pretend they're buying it as a gift. First published in 1961, it was reissued in a special paperback anniversary edition 3 years ago, with illustrations by Jules Pfeiffer and a preface by Morris Sendak. It has a lot of that magical, familiar world turned abruptly strange quality that readers love about the Harry Potter books. A boy named Milo, who's bored with life, comes home one day to find a huge package in his room bearing an envelope that reads, "For Milo, who has plenty of time." Inside is a disassembled, genuine turnpike toll booth, which Milo puts together and then drives his toy car through. What ensues is a journey that's been rightly compared to that of Alice in Wonderland, in which Milo rediscovers life's possibilities as he meets the weird, word-playing citizens of places like Dictionopolis and the Land of Expectations, the place you must always go to before you get to where you're going. A much more brutal journey is the subject of Conrad Richter's The Light in the Forest, a slim novel that's shelved both in the adult and children's sections of many bookstores. The Light in the Forest was first published in 1953, and it's one of those historical adventure tales that educates as it thrills. Set in 18th century America, the novel tells the story of True Son, a 15-year-old white boy who was kidnapped by Indians when he was a baby and adopted by them, but is now forced to return to his white family. What's so striking about The Light in the Forest is its uncompromising depiction of True Son's caught between two worlds situation. Also, the novel's description of the landscape primeval are as hypnotic as any James Fenimore Cooper rhapsody. Here's a passage about a soggy sojourn True Son and his Indian cousin undertake in the woods. They could hear the rain before it reached them, a fine, unmistakable roar in the forest. They lay snug under their upturned dugout, watching the trees drink in the wetness. Some days it fell with a long, soft, beautiful sound through the woods, so light at times they only knew it continued by the bushes delicately nodding. After a long day of rain, it seemed that this small, dry spot where they lay was the only place left on earth. Boys, 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 I asked my bookstore Virgil for a girl power book, and he recommended Dorothy Canfield Fisher's Understood Betsy, a 1917 classic that's just been reprinted in a pretty new hardcover edition. This is a wonderful story about a sheltered, insecure city girl who's sent to live with her tough-love Vermont relatives. They believe, rightly, that self-esteem develops out of learning how to fend for yourself. any overprotective parents out there probably need to read and absorb this novel's wise message of self-reliance at least as much as their kids do. All three of these very different, adult-attractive children's books create a rich, fully realized world pervaded sometimes by humor and in all cases by a real sense of evil and loss. Speaking of loss, happy and very prosperous holidays to my favorite beleaguered independent bookstore and its staff who recommended these books.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Beck's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Twenty-nine-year-old Beck Hansen has created a diverse body of music since he scored a hit with his song Loser in 1993. Working with equal interest in folk and hip-hop idioms, Beck has become an emblematic 90s artist, according to our rock critic Ken Tucker. He has a review of Beck's new CD, Midnight Vultures.
In a certain sense, Midnight Vultures is Beck's version of Prince's 1980 album Dirty Mind, ostensibly obsessed with sex but really more concerned with true love, deploying dependable funk rhythms as the basis for a series of unpredictable rock and roll riffs. This is the CD that captures the geeky white soul man that Beck frequently personifies in his live performances, and much of the time, he isn't even a geek.
It's business with leather.
There hasn't been a CD released all year that bursts with the unironic glee that Midnight Vultures emanates. It's obviously an extremely produced record. Beck layers his own vocals and keyboards and taps into prime George Clinton-style funk, complete with a close approximation of Clinton's hoarse yelling on a cut like Hollywood Freaks.
Hot milk. Tweak my nipple, champagne and ripple. Shamas go cripples.
Sales go triple.
We drop lobotomy beats. Evaporated meats in high-tech streets. We go solo. Dance floors and talk shows. Hot dogs, no-dos. Hot sex and back rows.
I wanna know what makes you scream. Be a $20 million fantasy. Treat you real good. Expensive jeans. Hollywood freaks from the Hollywood scene.
Guys are real good if you want a piece.
Keep my nose.
There are moments on Midnight Vultures that can make you laugh out loud. The juxtaposition of white and black rock and R&B are so startling, so instantly right, that you wonder why it's taken anyone this long to come up with a synthesis of styles such as Peaches and Cream.
Don't tell your right hand, baby, what your left hand do. You know those road check girls who make
You may have noticed by now that beyond the music, the words Beck is reciting don't make all that much literal sense. He was quoted a year ago when he was in the thick of crafting this CD as saying that what he wanted to do was make a, quote, big dumb pop record with dumb lyrics. He stayed true to his own directive with couplets like, I'm mixing business with leather, Christmas with heather, and this deathless quatrain. I think we're going crazy, her left eye is lazy, she looks so Israeli, nicotine and gravy. But the non sequiturs are a way for a young white man in love with black music to demonstrate his passion without making the cultural mistake of trying to pass. In the end, Beck's nonsense makes perfect sense.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Beck's new album, Midnight Vultures. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. And Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Tariq Rose. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Back Bay Books, publishers of The Physics of Christmas, From the Aerodynamics of Reindeer to the Thermodynamics of Turkey by Roger Highfield. Available in paperback wherever books are sold. From Smith & Hawken, for two decades and for every season, providing gardeners with tools, plants, wreaths, and home decor. On the web at smithandhawken.com. And from Delacourt Press, publisher of Lost in the Funhouse, The Life and Mind of Andy Kaufman, a look inside comedian Andy Kaufman's head. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The town is hard to stir in. The nightclubs all were closed.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, singer and songwriter Robbie Foulkes performs and tells us what he learned while trying to make it in Nashville. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Into the room they ran.